I know you've already touched on this. I mean, we're speaking broadly here about scaling, of course, and the challenges of that. But could you go into even more detail, maybe bring up some more examples and thoughts and your own experiences of what do you think are the main challenges when scaling successfully? What do you think about also transitioning from searching to scalable business model and actually scaling it? How do you go about that? What are the challenges?
Cool. So the way I look at this, so to get to that first, okay, to get to product market fit, like that's hard, right? As we were saying. So there's, we call it the first valley of death, right? Like the vast majority of entrepreneurs don't make it through it, or entrepreneurs don't make it through that, right? But to get, it's a huge accomplishment to get to product market fit. And then once you start scaling, we call that the second valley of death, because the vast majority of entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs don't make it through that one as well. There's a study we did where we saw half of startups fail before they within the first 5 years. We all know that, like, huge failure rate. But of those that continue on, only a half percent actually scale, right? And those that scale create all the jobs, all that we talk about, the great innovation engine, right? So this, the second valley of death, it's a company kind of has to make a bunch of transitions. You know, they transition from a team to like a business entity, from a founder to a CEO, from making decisions based on intuition to being more data-driven, from, first revenues to having a recurring, like, ongoing system in place with, product launches and quarterly, innovation updates, right? From local to international, right? So there's all these transitions that are going on in the company. And the way I look at also look at it is like, when this company starts out in the startup phase, the innovation engine is kicking in. Like, we're finding, well, I need to find, to get to product market fit, I need to find maybe 100 customers that really love my product. So I'm out there figuring out what they need and learning how to build it and figuring out they need and learning how to build it. So I got this engine running, right? And once I hit product market fit, like, that's not the end of that. We're going to continue to, like, find new features and new ways to make the product better and better and better. So that product's going, that engine's going right there. At the same time, now we've got to start, when we start scaling, we have to start bringing on the business engine, right? And we have to start, things change. Like, it's no longer we're going to have a team of 10 people where we can sit around a table and all make a decision, right? Now you're up to like maybe 50, 100 people, right? And you have, for your first time, you might have middle managers, and you might have not all be sitting in the same office, much less not even the same city. And you've got to start getting performance targets and thinking about how do we hire, and you have to think about, your roadmap, and you actually have breathing space to think about strategy instead of just not dying, right? So there's a lot of other things that are coming on. So the entrepreneurs I talk to are kind of ping-ponging between these two, constantly going back and forth. Like, one day, in the morning, I might work on creating a new, feature or product or something that I can roll out to keep that growth going with the customers. And even for the startups, it's really hard. Like, Brian Chesky at Airbnb talked about when they did the trip guides, like, that was it was hard for him to open up the space to get a team to actually work on it, because everyone's so busy over here in the business engine, like, building out the day-to-day operations. And so they go back and forth between the two, with, by the way, at the same time, getting random punches in the face.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. Back to
That's better
Airbnb,
than
Brian Chesky
getting
describes.
knocked out.
Yes. Yeah. Brian
Many small
Chesky just,
punches. It's okay.
yeah. He describes it as you're casually walking down the street and you get punched in the face, right? For him, it was two things. They got on the radar of competitors, and all of a sudden there were companies out there trying to put them out of business. And so they had to move so fast to expand to be first one there. And then the government started to crack down on them, right? And, in the corporate entrepreneurship, one of the advantages a startup has is nobody knows them. No, you can fly under the radar for a long time. But if you're at Google and you launch a new product, everybody notices, and competitors start coming after you, and the punches start coming really fast. So it's that ping pong between those two states while, looking out for punches in the space. Like, that's kind of how it goes once they start scaling. But I think what's really important for them to focus on is kind of three main things. Or when I work with them, I focus on three main things. One is leadership, which we talked about, because at the end of the day, I feel like leadership is just about everything. it's so much is dependent on it. And it's hard because that's, you know, it's a touchy-feely, non-concrete subject, but leadership. The second one, you kind of referenced it before, is thinking big. And I think this is the biggest advantage that startups have, is that they, you know, they're used to thinking big. They want to disrupt. They're looking to make something 10x better. And if you're at a really big company, oftentimes there's a conservative mindset, like we have to protect and no, we can't be that risky. So sometimes, like when I work with teams, they need some help to help them think big. And then the third one kind of is this journey that we're talking about, ping-ponging back and forth and kind of knowing what's going to be happening. It also, I feel like there's kind of, in this journey, there's two different types of scaling that are out there. One is what I'm going to call like the Silicon Valley style of scaling. And I just do that because that's my own reference point. But, you know,
it's
if
like
I look
all in.
Yeah. But, you know, you look at WhatsApp, right? They got to 200 million active users. They're $1.5 billion valuation at that point in time when they sold. And they had 50 staff members in one office. And pretty much everybody globally had the same product, right? And so for those guys to scale, it's growth hacking. Like that's what they need to do. And they need to get really good at that and growth hack. And so those are the concrete skills that they need to have when they're on their innovation engine, they're ping ponging back and forth, right? So that's the skills they need to focus on. The other type of scaling is when I'd say you move to a new territory, and that could be a new geography. Like I'm going from France to Brazil, or it can be like I sell washing machines and I sell them to the hotel industry. And now I'm selling them to hospitals, right? So it's something new. And here you have to figure out, their challenge is a little bit more around figuring out kind of what I'm going to say is the recipe. So for example, there's one business we were working with that was a school educational company. And they're going from Mexico to India. So they have to figure out, is the product going to be the same in India? Are we going to adjust it? Well, who's going to adjust it? Is that adjusted by the Mexican team or the Indian team? Who adjusts the pricing? Is the pricing the same? Who figures out the hiring, the strategy of the product? Because now we've got two different versions. Do they go independent or do they work together? And so there's all these ingredients that you need to be successful. And people really have to, when they go international, they have to think through this recipe.
Which makes you kind of fall back into experimentation for a while before you maybe find whatever product market fit means in that market before you can scale there. So it's not always like a complete clear, now we start scaling and that's the only thing we're going to do. Sometimes we'll fall back again in search mode before we can move forward.
Yeah, with some politics, because who's going to be running the experiments and who's going to be making the calls? Yeah, so it's experimentation with politics. And I kind of feel like there's two different, the two extremes would be what I call the French fry model, where, you know, everywhere you go on McDonald's globally, I don't care what country you're in, the French fry is the same. Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to call it the chicken soup model. Like every country has its own chicken soup, you know, Mexican chipotle chicken soup, Italian, you know, chicken noodle soup. Mm-hmm. Everybody does their own thing. Usually you're in the middle somewhere with some things centralized and some things at the country, but you kind of have to figure that one out.
But that's the thing. I mean, in a way, to be able to scale, the holy grail there is to make it repeatable and hopefully you can automate a lot of things as well. So I think many times the scaling effort falls apart when you gain new clients and they want their own little versions of the product and so on. And then suddenly you end up being a consultancy because you're trying to do everything for everyone, right? So I think that's also a very important issue in scaling, that they need to really know what kind of customer are we going to be serving and what is our product going to look like for that segment. And that's it. And if you can't have a big enough market for that, then it's going to be difficult to scale, of course. Then you're in a niche market. But that's always the issue, I guess. What about, because I'm curious also about, you did some research on scaling, some survey you spoke about. I'd love to hear more about that as well. And also if there was anything about the difference between successful and less successful team scaling, those that had very strong core values and a very strong vision compared to those who didn't, if there's anything like that. Because we talk a lot about the importance of passion, having passionate entrepreneurs who really have a very clear idea of what it is that they're trying to change, right, in the world, rather than having a team that has all kinds of ideas and running in different directions, right? So
yeah.
Was that something that you guys picked up in your research as well and you could measure and see the
success? Yes. So, it's funny. We're build measuring learning with our own research.
Right.
So the first round of questions, we didn't ask about passion and grit. And then we had an open field at the end and everybody came back whether they're scaling or not scaling. Like, that was a huge thing. They're like, this is probably the most important thing. So, hopefully the next round we'll get some more insights on that.
Yeah. Because the shared values and that clear vision, it sort of helps them to prioritize what's important. And if the team then is doesn't have that at the core, then everything seems like an opportunity, and everything shouldn't be an opportunity, because if it is, it's just going to slow them down. They're not going to find that thing that they can actually scale. So
yeah,
I guess that's
no, it's true. And we found like there's some interesting things kind of around the passion and mindset of the founders. So for example, we'd ask them, are you more opportunistic or perfecting what you have? Mm-hmm. And it turns out that those that are scaling are much more opportunistic, which kind of makes sense if you think about it from the lean startup. Like, you're always moving and kind of finding that next opportunity instead of sitting here and saying, no, I can't go until I make it more perfect, right? Mm-hmm. We asked him, do you seek ideas from my own field, or do you look out to other fields to get inspiration and start pulling from different places? Significantly, those that are scaling up tend to get ideas from their own field, and those that are stalling are pulling in kind of probably too many different things or far away from that.
Kind of scratch your own itch. That's usually where entrepreneurship begins.
That's a much better
because it's
way,
your own passion that you really want to solve this problem, because it's a problem that you had yourself.
Yeah.
If you can find enough other people who have that problem, then you potentially have a market to scale into.
Yes.
What about, there was another thing I just read, which I kind of liked in relation to scaling. The founder should be working on the business, not in the business. So kind of delegation, not you know, control and letting go and trying to take a step back to facilitate whatever is going on there towards scaling. I think that was a nice quote I found. The founders are working on the business, not in it.
I like that way. Yeah. I might borrow that quote.
I don't know who said it first. I have no idea.
I saw an interview with Brian Chesky, and he was saying, you know, when you start the company, you do everything as a founder.
Exactly.
I've been in early stage startups where I've done everything from going to IKEA and buying desks and assembling them.
IKEA, Swedish?
Yeah, there you go. Swedish modern, we call it? Yes. But like over time, at this point in time, this is going, you know, different skills. Like, you go from the basketball player to the diver to the baseball player. He works mostly on hiring and strategy, right? Mm. Very different than what you do in culture, hiring, strategy, and culture. Mm. So very, very different. Yeah, I agree. And that's actually a good way of saying it. He's working on the business, not in the business. Mm.
Referencing IKEA, I just read recently that they bought TaskRabbit, so that instead of customers have to assemble the furniture themselves, now they can just click a button and someone comes home and does it for them.
So it makes sense, because most people have to hire someone to put the furniture together.
That's the thing. I mean, even IKEA, as huge as it is, still is thinking, how can we continue scaling? There's still some customers who are not buying it from us because they want to build the furniture themselves. So let's buy TaskRabbit, and then we can expand our market and continue scaling.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of sweet. I wonder what they paid.
But I think it's a brilliant, I think it's a very smart acquisition. Just on the first, like, I don't know what they paid either, but on the surface, it seems like a good idea.
Yeah. But it took them time to get to that point.
Yeah.
IKEA has been around for a long time.
Yeah. And so it's funny when people look, companies are looking to get growth. And so there's a couple of different, there's two main ways they can do it. They can acquire a company, or they can try to build it themselves. Mm. And I feel like acquiring a company kind of has they both are incredibly difficult, right? Like, they both have mass amounts of failure. I read studies that are between for M&A is between like 60-70% of them don't work. But I think those averages hide a kind of the true story, because I think the true story is there are some companies out there that are phenomenally good at acquiring and integrating, like Cisco, really, really good at doing that.
And then others that are not so, like Yahoo. I don't know. I mean, Mirsha Mayer's strategy of acquihires, she was really going on a buying spree. That didn't pan out so well. So the challenges in both acquiring and building, of course.
Right. Yeah. And I think the interesting thing, like the ones who do it well, then they come in and they take kind of, you know, either way, whether you build it or you buy it, they're kind of pulling in companies oftentimes that have that product market fit already. And then it's a question of scaling. And so that would be another path for companies, is they have to get really good at integrating and thinking about that. Cisco has an entire team. Like the day that you get bought, like there's a team that mobilizes and puts you in place. Pharmaceutical firms are also amazing at this. You know, they've almost outsourced all their R&D to independent biotechs that they have, you know, sometimes they do an early investment in to kind of get a call option. And when it goes big, then they integrate it in and push it out through their distribution system. Endemol, one of the publishing companies in the Netherlands, is also very good. Well, they do it more internally, but they're basically getting new ideas and pushing it out through their distribution system. There is a very big skill around it.